and Fiona did her PhD in principle, and now she's a postdoc at Oxford, and she's talking about building fractional topological insulators.
Thanks. So before I start, I'll say it's great to be here. Thanks very much for coming and listening. And the other thing is, I notice especially there's a lot of students here, and you know, please don't hesitate to stop me early on if there's something that you don't understand. And if that slows things down and we don't get to the end, I don't think that'll be a serious problem. So I'm told that this is the pointer of choice. And before I start, also, I want to acknowledge the collaborators on this work. So Mike Levin, who is now at the University of Maryland, and Maciek Kosh-Janush and Adi Stern, both of whom are at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Cool. All right. So here's the rough program. So I'm going to start by saying, by giving a little bit of background material. So I'm going to say a few things about topological insulators for people who maybe haven't heard much about them before. And I'm going to say a little bit about fractionalization, because these are the two ingredients that we're going to try and kind of put together in this talk. And then after that, I'm going to tell you about some model Hamiltonians that we can write down that realize what I'm going to call fractional topological insulators. And I'll say more about what we mean by that in a few minutes. And then the last part of the talk is going to be about asking whether, okay, so we have these sort of candidate fractional topological insulators. And then I'm going to ask the question, you know, are these really fractional topological insulators? And for those who maybe know a little bit about topological insulators, what that's going to mean is, do they really have time reversal protected edge modes? Okay, so let's start by talking about insulators. So the most common kind of insulator that we find in nature, and you know, until relatively recently, maybe people kind of thought this was the whole story, is what I'm going to call an ordinary insulator. And so in an ordinary insulator, you know, basically the idea is if I look at the many body ground state, either it's just a product of you know, a bunch of electrons that are kind of sitting on little localized sites, or you can take the system, you know, maybe it's a band insulator, maybe I can stretch it out or something like that, but I can deform it in some continuous way without going through a phase transition and end up, you know, in a state where all of these guys are just kind of, all of the electrons are kind of sitting in their little local states and they're not talking to each other. Okay. And so here's a sort of picture of this. If you actually are thinking about sort of band insulators, here's what it looks like. So let's say that I had so schematically I have a valence band. Okay, so here's a bunch of filled states, and I have a gap, and then I have a conduction band up here, and these are a bunch of empty states. And the thing that I want to emphasize, okay, about this picture, is that you know, maybe I'm a numericist, and maybe I'm diagonalizing my Hamiltonian. And basically, independently of how I choose the boundary conditions, so maybe I choose periodic boundary conditions, maybe I choose open boundary conditions, generically, there don't need to be any states in this gap here. And if there are states, I can always do sort of something to get rid of them. Okay. Now, the second kind of insulator that we know about, it's kind of going in chronological order, is what I'm going to call a Chern insulator. And this is the kind of insulator that's associated with the integer quantum Hall effects. Okay, so what are these? Well, these are insulators in which, you know, if you want to kind of get to this picture here, well, all the electrons are, you know, sitting on their little isolated sites and they're not talking to each other, you have to go through a phase transition. And hand in hand with this comes the fact that if we go over here into this sort of picture of the band structure, you always have to have, crossing between this valence band and this conduction band, some kind of edge state. So now you can see that no matter, so, well, you find a state, right? Okay, and the state you'll see, if you look at the actual wave function, it's localized at the edge. And this necessarily means, because you can see anywhere that I want to put my chemical potential in this gap, okay, I have to cross this line, so there's always going to be sort of gapless excitations that live at the edge of the system. And there's, if you want to think about the quantum Hall effect, there's a really great cartoon picture of this, which is this here. So basically, you know, the quantum Hall effect, what I do is I take a bunch of electrons that are sort of confined to move in two dimensions, and I apply a large magnetic field. And so what does this do? Well, semi-classically, what this does is the electrons want to go in their little cyclotron orbits. So in most parts of the sample, the electrons are pretty happy, and maybe they go in their little cyclotron orbits, and maybe they don't really talk to each other. But this electron here at the edge, okay, so it tries to go around its cyclotron orbit, but then it hits the edge of the system. So it turns out that what it does, semi-classically, is it just kind of bounces along this edge, okay? So you can see that And basically, because there's a preferred direction of rotation due to the magnetic field, this means that electrons move in one direction along the edge. Okay, and that's exactly what you associate with this edge mode here. Okay. And finally, there's what I'm going to call topological insulators. So these are quite similar to Chern insulators, except in some sense they're a little bit more delicate. So the statement is that you can't get to this picture up here, okay, unless you either go through a phase transition, as was the case for a Chern insulator, or simply break a symmetry. And in this case, the important symmetry is time reversal symmetry. Okay. And just as the Chern insulator had this, you know, this one edge mode crossing between the valence band and the conduction band, and that was associated with a flow of electrons in one direction along the edge of the system. Okay, so the analog of that in topological insulators is that you actually have time reversal protected gapless edge modes and what those look like. So here's my electron sort of moving along the edge in the quantum Hall effect. So the simplest way to imagine what's going on in a topological insulator is what we call the spin Hall effect. And that's basically two copies of an integer quantum Hall state, one of which has spin up and magnetic field sort of coming out of the page so that the spin up electrons are propagating to the right, and one of which has spin down and magnetic field going sort of into the page, and so those electrons are propagating to the left. Okay, so you can see there's no net charge being transported in this, but there is a net spin current, so that's why they call it the quantum spin Hall state. And so now if I look at sort of what's going on in the kind of band language here, so again, I have a valence band and a conduction band, and now what I'll find if I look at this Hamiltonian on a system with open boundary conditions is I'll see that there's a spin-up sort of edge mode crossing from the valence band to the conduction band like this, and a spin-down mode crossing like this. And I just wanted to say, so what's different, you know, between this picture and this picture? So, you know, in the quantum Hall case, basically you have one low energy thing living at the edge, okay, and that's this electron that's going in one direction only. So even if you allow electron-electron interactions so that these can scatter off each other, you know, really all the electrons are moving in the same direction, so there's no way to stop them. Now you might if you look at this model, okay, there's electrons moving to the right and electrons moving to the left. So generically, if you add an interaction, right, and you have things moving in opposite directions, they can run into each other and actually sort of basically at low energies, you can open a gap. They bump into each other and they sort of, you know, stop propagating. But what happens here is you see that if you want to kind of change something, if you want to flip something from moving to the right to the left, to moving to the left, you have to also flip the spin. Okay, so and in order to flip the spin, you have to add some kind of magnetic impurity, which is going to break time reversal. So that's why these edge modes are protected by time reversal. Yeah?
System, how do you arrange this magnetic field that points in two different directions?
Okay, right. So that was a cartoon picture. So in a realistic system, this is actually something that happens spontaneously in the material itself. So it's actually, right. So that was just kind of a cartoon picture for how to visualize it in terms of this, but this is a property of the band structure. So topological insulators, you know, they exist in two dimensions. That's the spin Hall effect, which is the picture that I just described. And they also exist in three dimensions, and these have been seen experimentally in both cases. So this is like one of my favorite pictures. This is an ARPES, so basically sort of a photon scattering experiment that's very sensitive to the surface states. And what you're looking at here, sorry, let me back up for one second. So if you're talking about a three-dimensional topological insulator, the analog of these you know, spin up propagating one way and spin down propagating another way is you actually have a single surface Dirac cone, okay, where the electron spin is coupled. There's a spin orbit coupling, and the spin is coupled to the direction of the momentum. So like, you know, if you took one a kind of so here's a picture of what's going on as you go around the Dirac cone, and if you take a snapshot at a particular, you know, along some line in momentum space, you would see that there's an electron at plus k with a spin going one direction, an electron at the opposite minus k with a spin going the other, pointing in the other way. Right. Okay. So now let me come back to this picture here. So what they measure is basically the kind of the density of states on the surface, and you can detect experimentally that This is what's going on in the bulk. Okay, these are the bulk bands, and you can detect these surface states, and you can really see that they have this Dirac comb-like structure. Okay. So one reason people are pretty excited about topological insulators is that, hey, they exist. That's always a good thing. But let me say, maybe sort of from a more theoretical perspective, what's the big deal here? And the big deal is, okay, these are effects, so the integer quantum Hall effect is something that happens, you know, you can understand without thinking about interactions. Topological insulators are, you know, it's a band structure effect. So these are really effects in systems where there's no electron-electron interaction. And so even without that, actually, there are different kinds of insulators. And this is surprising, right? This is not something that, you know, for a long time people didn't think that was the case. And so why is it kind of surprising? Well, you know, in the bulk of the system, everything, you know, if I look locally at the bulk of these systems, they all look kind of the same, right? There's a valence band, and there's a conduction band, and there's a gap, and that's an insulator, right? But so the interesting thing about Chern insulators and topological insulators is that there's a sort of global property of the band structure that means that the physics at the boundary of the system is very different, right? So topological insulators and Chern insulators have gapless edge modes. Ordinary insulators generically do not. Okay. right. Now, so the next thing I wanted to say a little bit about was fractionalization. And so basically, you know, if you start thinking in this way, you know, what kind of different insulators can we have? Well, so I just said that without electron-electron interactions, you know, we can have ordinary insulators or topological insulators or Chern insulators. So now if we throw interactions into the picture, of course, you can get a very large number of other things. And one of the things that you can get is if you have very strong interactions, you can actually end up in a phase where basically the low, so at high energies, you know, I have a system that I made out of, say, electrons, okay? But when I look at it at low energies and I ask, well, what are the kind of excitations that I should think about in the low energy physics, those excitations might look like they carry actually some fraction, for example, of the electron charge. This is what we call fractionalization. And again, this is something that we know exists in nature. So the first sort of really striking experimental example of this was what we call the fractional quantum Hall effect. So I told you a little bit about the integer quantum Hall effect, and basically the like really crude picture of the fractional quantum Hall effect is that when I look at the edge of my system, okay, and I ask what's going on near the edge, the very naive cartoon picture of that phase is instead of having an electron bouncing along my edge, I have some kind of excitation of this very strongly correlated fluid that carries some fraction of the electron charge, maybe a third of the electron charge. Okay. So I'm not going to say very much about the fractional quantum Hall effect. It's a very broad subject. But let me just kind of give you a bit of a perspective of where I'd like to go in this talk. So we said there's non-interacting electrons. And in particular, we're interested in insulators. Okay, and I have three kinds of insulators here. Now, if we sort of increase the complexity of the problem and I say, well, let me actually not think about non-interacting electrons, but instead very strongly interacting electrons, and let me ask about gapped phases of strongly interacting electrons, well, some of those gapped phases can be fractionalized, okay? And we know that in nature there's a kind of a fractional analog of the Chern insulator, okay, of the quantum Hall effect, which is the fractional quantum Hall effect. So the question that I'm going to talk about today is there also some kind of fractionalized analog of a topological insulator? Right? Okay. So far all good? Cool. Okay. So I'm gonna talk about sort of two separate aspects of this question. And the first question, oh, sorry. And let me just say, really, for the purposes of this talk, I want to focus on 3D topological insulators. So there's been some previous work on two-dimensional versions of fractional spin Hall effect. So really, our objective was to build a fractional topological insulator in three dimensions. Okay. So the first question is, you know, can I write down some Hamiltonian and show that this Hamiltonian has like a single Dirac cone on the surface, but where the carriers, the charge carriers that are, you know, going into this Dirac cone carry some fraction of the electron charge. Okay? So I want to do this in a way that I can make very precise. So what I'm going to do is write down an exactly solvable, you know, lattice model. Okay, and this lattice model is going to have fermionic excitations that carry fractional charge. But basically, because it's exactly solvable, I'm going to be able to define a sort of notion of band structure. So basically, I'm going to be able to put my fractionally charged fermions into a band structure. Okay, and then as soon as we know that they have a band structure, we'll be able to put them in the band structure of a topological insulator. Okay, so that's going to be sort of the name of the game in terms of constructing models. Yeah?
Another kind of fractionalization that comes up is the having excitations which have charge and no spin, or ones
right.
that have spin and no
right.
charge,
right.
so-called spin-offs and hole-offs. Is that kind of thing relevant to what you're looking at here?
That's an interesting question, actually, in the sense that, I mean, so in the Chern insulator, spin is not very important. In the topological insulator, obviously, it is. I haven't really thought about that much. I think it's interesting. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit after the talk, but it's a good question.
So, and then the next question. So, okay. So we're going to write down these models, and we're going to say, well, you know, these models sort of map onto models of non-interacting fermions that carry fractional charge, and so it looks like you've made a fractional topological insulator. So now the next question that I like to ask is, you know, are these really fractional topological insulators? Okay, so you write down this model, and it's exactly solvable, and in order to do that, you have to make the interactions in the model sort of very special. Okay, so generically, you would be, if you wanted to imagine any kind of physical system, you could really realize you wouldn't be exactly at this solvable point. So what you want to know is that these edge modes are some feature of the phase. Okay. So I'm going to try and present some arguments demonstrating that some of these have time reversal protected edge modes, but not all of them. Okay. Good. All right. So let's start with the models. So how am I going to get a model that has fractionally charged fermions? Well, basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by writing down a model of strongly interacting bosons that's going to have excitations that have some fraction, I'm going to call it 1 over p, of the fundamental bosonic charge. Okay. Now, the reason that this is a sort of natural approach is because there are already in existence, people have known for a while, about a variety of bosonic models that have very similar properties to the ones that I'm going to tell you about today. Now, what's special about our models is that, of course, so it's important for a topological insulator that the electromagnetic charge is conserved. Okay, so that's going to be important to me. And so I'm going to write down a bosonic model that is charge conserving, okay, and also exactly solvable. So for people who might be familiar with some of these models up here, that's kind of the difference between what I'm going to tell you about and what you might have heard about, for example, if you studied the toric code. Good. Okay, so now once I have my model with fractionally charged bosons, the game is going to be to couple these fractionally charged bosonic excitations to fermions. So basically, I'm going to add a term that says, well, I can make a fermion provided that it's very tightly bound, kind of stuck onto some number, k, of these fractionally charged bosonic excitations. So once I do that, I have fractionally charged fermions, and the important thing is that it's actually going to turn out that we can add some kinetic energy for these fermions and put them in a band structure. Okay, and that's how we get actually a fractional topological insulator. Good. Okay. So, all right. So one caveat is, as I said, you know, really what I think is sort of the most exciting part of this is you can build, you know, something that looks like a fractional topological insulator in three dimensions. However, I find pictures are much easier to understand in two dimensions. So for the most part, I'm actually going to draw two-dimensional pictures. I just want to say, you know, the model works basically the same way in three dimensions. There's no fundamental differences. Okay. So what is the model? Okay, so let me start by telling you about the bosonic model. and let's look at the square lattice over here. So I'm going to have bosons that can live either on the sites of the square lattice or on the links of the square lattice. Okay. And the sites of the square lattice, basically, I should think of these as being like quantum dots. Okay, so they have some large mean occupancy of bosons. And I'm going to define a number, I'm going to call it ns, which is going to be the boson number on the site relative to this mean occupancy. Okay, so in fact, this NS, and you'll see in a few slides, this NS can be negative, and that's sort of that's important. And okay, and on the sites are a little different. So I'm going to focus on the simplest case. So remember the boson charge. I said the charge of the bosonic excitations is going to be some fraction 1 over p of the fundamental boson charge. So I'm mostly going to talk about the case that p is equal to 2 today, simply because it's a little bit simpler than the other ones, but you can actually do this whole construction for any p that you want. So for p equals 2, what happens on the sites of the lattice is basically you could imagine that I have a very strong like Hubbard repulsion term on the sites of the lattice. And that means that, you know, effectively, at the energy scales that I'm interested in, I can have at most one boson on each link. Okay, so we're going to work in the representation where these are hardcore bosons. And if you want to do this at general p, it's some kind of p state system. So like a pot spin on each link. Okay, so that's the Hilbert space. When I add the fermions, they're just going to live on these sites here, as we'll see in a little bit. Okay, and so now exactly solvable model. So what I'm going to do? Well, my Hamiltonian is going to have a potential energy term, and that's going to be an interaction between the site and the links around the site, and it's going to have a kinetic term. Okay, and the special thing about this kinetic term is actually going to involve what we call ring exchange, or kind of simultaneous hopping of a bunch of bosons around a plaquette. And what's special about that is that you can arrange that so that the kinetic and the potential energies actually commute. Okay, and this is how you get an exactly solvable model. Okay. All right. So what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about these two interactions. And what I'm going to try and emphasize is how you actually get a fractional charge in this model. Okay. So the potential term is the square of some operator that I'm going to call QS. And what does QS care about? Well, it basically, it kind of cares about like a weighted average of the charge around the site. So it looks at the total number of bosons on the links around the site, plus twice, in the case P equals 2, the number of bosons on the site. Okay. Now, a kind of useful way to think about what this term is actually doing for you is to ask, okay, well, let's say I pick the configuration of bosons on the link. When can I actually make this QS squared equal to 0? Okay. And what you find if you start drawing these configurations is that, you know, so this factor of 2 is very important because if I choose the total number of bosons on the links around the site to be even, then I can always make QS equal to 0 by subtracting an appropriate number of bosons off the site itself. Okay. Yeah.
Charge. It's something else.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, yeah, so yeah, it's not the total charge. It's a weighted average. So I mean, if you pick your geometry carefully, you might say like, you know, each link is shared between two sites, so I should like, you know, have this factor of 2 here to justify that in some kind of electrostatic. But really,
I'm just asking about this factor of 2.
That's right. Yeah. So that's right. So the charge of the bosons is the same whether they sit on the sites of the links, and this factor of 2 is something else. Okay. Right. Yeah. But it's important because what it means is that if I choose to put an odd number of bosons on the links around the site, then actually, you know, because of this factor of 2, the best I can do is to get QS squared equal to 1. Okay. So what this term is really doing for you is it's telling you, you know, okay, if I have an even number of bosons, I can be in the ground state. If I have an odd number of bosons on the links around here, I necessarily have some kind of excitation. Okay. So that's kind of the way to think about this. Yeah.
2 is 1.9 or 1.8. The model has qualitatively the same behavior because this is still the ground state.
Yeah.
Or is it really an integer of 2?
So you can't get QS equals 0 if it's 1.9. That's not going to make a
difference. Right, but he's saying, you know, the spectrum is discrete, and so as long as, yeah, you know, the eigenvalue, the minimum, you know, as long as for an even number, the minimum eigenvalue is like. Now, what.
It's the same. Yeah,
is So sort of the best I can do here is smaller than the best I can do here. Qualitatively, the physics would be the same. Yeah.
It would be a shame if in a real material you had to tune this number to an integer. So you need some.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair. That's very fair. I mean, you have to be a little careful because, of course, you know. Okay. So yeah. Let me. There's something that there's one other ingredient in this that may be a little important, but let me come back to that in a minute. So right. So we said, so one property of this is basically, you know, it cares about this evenness and oddness. Okay. Now, another thing that's very important is that this operator, if I just specify what QS is on a site, that there's still a large degeneracy. So, for example, if I tell you that QS is going to be 1 here, I could put 1 boson on one of these links. Okay, that would give me QS equals 1. I could also put 3 bosons on the links and take 1 off the site. This also gives me QS equals 1. Okay, so I have a kind of ground state degeneracy, and also for any sort of excited state, there's a big degeneracy. So so the kinetic term, what it's going to do is, you know, break this degeneracy. So all right, so let's talk about the kinetic term. So, you know, basically, you might imagine that what's a kinetic term? Well, it's going to involve some hopping between the sites and the links and the lattice. So here's a good candidate term. I'm going to, you know, hop a site from the link here to the site over here, and then sorry, hop a boson and hop another boson from or you know, hop another boson from here over to here. So the problem with just writing down this term here, okay, is that when this process changes the eigenvalue of QS at both of these sites here, okay, because basically I've taken one boson off of the site, and I put it on the link, but because of this factor of 2, that has changed the eigenvalue of QS. Okay, so, and that's not what I want, because as I said, I want these two terms in the Hamiltonian to commute so that my model is exactly solvable. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the product of this kind of hopping operator around all 4 links in a plaquette. Okay, so now what that means is that, you know, basically this factor of U12 wants to for example, lower QS here, but then the next factor is going to want to raise it, and so QS is conserved. So for example, what's going on in this picture here is, let's just look at this site. So I have one boson that's going onto the link here, so this is going to increase by 1, and the number of bosons on this link is going to increase by 1, but at the same time, I've taken one boson off this site. Okay, so that's going to give me a minus 2, and you see that QS hasn't changed. Okay. So perfect. So QS is going to commute with this kinetic, with this this plaquette operator, this BP. And so this is going to be my Hamiltonian. And again, it's a sum of a kinetic term and a potential term, and these two commute. Okay, so I can solve for the spectrum exactly. And the important thing about this kinetic term is, as I said, you know, before, when I just told you what QS was, it was big degeneracy. Okay. And basically, what this kinetic term is doing is it's mixing between different states in this degeneracy. And it turns out that if I look at only wave functions that are ground states of this piece here, and I specify QS, okay, then what happens is I get an equal amplitude superposition, okay, of all of the possible occupation numbers of the link bosons that are compatible with that choice of QS, okay. And it's this superposition that actually gives me fractional charge. So let's look at how that works. So one way to look at how that works is actually just to count. Okay. So in my ground state, as I said, not ground state, but let's say that I'm in the ground state of the kinetic term of the Hamiltonian. Okay. And I want to calculate and I want to compare the charge at this site if it's in the state QS equals 0. To the charge at the site if it's in the state QS equals 1. Okay, so as I said, in both cases, what the wave function is going to do is it's going to be in an equal amplitude superposition of all of the configurations, okay, around this site that are compatible with that choice of QS. So if I pick QS is equal to 0, there's one choice in which I make all of these links unoccupied. Okay, and of course there's also one choice when I make them all occupied. And then there are 6 ways to put bosons on exactly 2 of the links, okay? And all of these are states that give you QS equals 0. So I'm just going to average over all of these configurations, and the average charge on the links is going to be 2, and the average charge on the sites is going to be -1. And so let's compare that to what happens if QS is equal to 1. So there's a couple of ways to get QS equals 1. There's 4 ways to put exactly 1 boson on one of these links, and there's 4 ways to put 3 bosons on these links. And in this case, again, the average charge on the links is 2. But now the average charge on this actual site is -0.5. Okay? So basically the conclusion from this argument is that if I calculate the expectation of the number of bosons at this site in the state with QS equal to 1 and subtract from that the expectation of the number of bosons with QS equals 0, in the case I showed you it was 1/2, and in general it's going to be 1 over p. Okay? So basically if I put QS equals 1 on one site, that's going to give me an excitation with a bosonic excitation with a charge of QB, the boson charge, over P. Okay. Now, I just want to emphasize one thing about this, which is, of course, the total system is made up of bosons carrying some, so that's some integer multiple of the boson charge. So, and this is sort of, if you're bored, you can play this game. It's kind of fun. So you can convince yourself that if I pick one site here, okay, and make the number of bosons on the links around this site, the total number odd, okay, then I must have some other site in the system where also the total number of bosons, okay, is odd. And so that means that in the p equals 2 case, these things really have to exist in pairs. Okay, so the total charge is always an integer. I do. Yeah. So in fact, this is what I'm describing for general p is a family of Hamiltonians. There's for each value of p, the Hamiltonian has the spectrum is a little bit different. For example, the charges of the excitations will be different. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And your claim is that, go back one slide, please.
Yeah.
And your claim is that if we did the exercise of diagonalizing the kinetic term,
yeah,
the states would actually all appear with equal
weight. With equal amplitude, yeah. That's the, yeah. I mean, intuitively, what you want to do is kind of look at what this kinetic term is doing, and okay, what is it if you actually write out these states with bosonic occupation numbers, you'll see that it's mapping between different ones, and the coefficients are always kind of give you this equal amplitude superposition. Right. Okay. So I've accomplished my first objective, which is to write down a bosonic model that. Okay. So yeah, I didn't emphasize this, but this bosonic model, the total boson number is conserved. Okay. So the total electric charge is conserved. So it's charge conserving. It's exactly solvable. And hopefully I've convinced you that it has these excitations that can carry some fraction of the fundamental boson charge. Okay. So now how do I make a fractional fermion? Well,
I'm sorry to take so long.
No, that's cool.
So in the previous example, you looked at the ground state of the kinetic term.
Yeah.
And the ground state and the excited state of the potential term.
Right, and I compared
the. You can always adjust things so that the first excited state of the kinetic term is above, so you don't have to worry about that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So this is another very important point. So you might worry. Let me go back to my Hamiltonian. So you might worry, kinetic terms that we're used to actually have some kind of continuous spectrum, right? So you might be worried that how can I control this? One of the interesting features of this term is if you actually write this out, and basically because the bosons on the link are hardcore bosons, or more generally they're sort of p state bosonic systems, if you actually take this operator bp to the p, that gives you 1. Okay, and so the spectrum of this kinetic term, so its spectrum is like a discrete gauge theory, and it's discrete, and so that's how I know that I can. By making this coefficient sufficiently large, I can control for that. Yeah. No, that's a very important point. Great. Yeah, okay, so now let's add fermions. So the way I'm going to do that is very simple. All I'm going to do is I'm going to modify this potential interaction. So I'm going to define a new operator, which is just this operator QS from the bosonic Hamiltonian minus some number k, which again I get to pick, times the number of fermions on this site. Okay, total number of fermions, spin up plus spin down. And so what this does is, okay, so now, as before, if I picked QS to equal K, well, that would be some excitation, but I can get back to the zero energy state of the potential term by adding a fermion. Okay, and so, I'm going to call these composite fermions because it really is one fermion bound to K of these fractionally charged bosonic excitations. And the charge of the fermion is simply 1 times the electric charge. So it's bare charge plus the charge of these K bosonic excitations. Now, so for this formula, we picked the charge of the boson to be 2E, okay, because you might want to think about this as being a system that I could make purely out of fermions. And so then these bosons would be, for example, very tightly bound pairs of fermions. And so that's where this factor of 2 comes from. But you can see that, so now, okay, even though I told you about p equals 2, actually I'm more interested in p bigger than 2, where I really get a fractional charge over here. Okay. Well, so that wasn't too hard to make the fermions fractionally charged. Right. Okay. Yeah. Basically. So here's my Hamiltonian, actually. And so, you know, there's three terms. So this is just the fermion number. So this. Right. Yeah. 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 Because so this piece, obviously, you know, right now it's just the fermion number, some chemical potential that commutes with everyone. So I have three kinds of excitations. I could violate this term. Yeah, that's going to cost very high energy. I could violate the kinetic term. I want that also to cost very high energy. Or I could make a fermion, and so that costs some energy mu.
Right. So if you let mu be finite and send v to infinity, that's the binding force that you're talking about.
Yes, that's right. Good. That's right. Yeah. And so perfect. So basically, I want to work in the kind of subspace where, let's imagine that we're at low enough energies, that the only kind of excitations that are going to be excited are these fermions. So I have my fermions. Now, if I just have a chemical potential, you know, each site either has a fermion or doesn't have a fermion, and that's not very exciting. So what I want to be able to do is give these fermions a band structure. And the important, the crucial point is that I can give the fermions a band structure, a kinetic energy, in such a way that I don't spontaneously excite any of these other excitations. So I don't create violations of this term, and I don't create violations of this term. In other words, I can write down a fermionic kinetic term that actually commutes with these two operators. Okay. So how do you do that? Well, you know, basically, I just need to create a kinetic term that's going to both hop the fermion from site S to site S prime, and also simultaneously hop K of these fractionally charged bosons. And that operator turns out to be this thing that I was calling U, okay, that sort of moves the bosons, moves them from here to here or here to here. Take that to the power of K, and that is going to exactly lower the eigenvalue of QS by K at one end of the link in the lattice and raise it at the other end by K. Okay. So basically this is an operator that is just hopping your fractionally charged fermions, your sort of composite fermions. Okay. So the important point is, so here's my Hamiltonian. I have some kinetic term now for the fermions, but it has this property that it commutes, okay, with both of these pieces here. So now at low energies, at low energies, I can just focus on the fermionic sector, and this really honestly looks like I've just picked, T is just telling me about the band structure. I've just picked a band structure for my composite fermions, which carry fractional charge. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so I'm not going to say too much about the band structure itself, but you know, basically the upshot is we pick the band structure that people know gives you a topological insulator in the non-interacting case, okay, and you just stick that in here. You do it in the three-dimensional model, and okay, and then you know that you're going to get these surface Dirac cones because you know what that band structure behaves like, right? What it does for you, and at the same time, this Dirac cone, you know, the carriers here are carrying some fractional charge. So this is exactly what we said, you know, would look like our candidate fractional topological insulator, fractionally charged gapless surface states. Okay. So before I go on to ask whether these sort of really are topological insulators, let me just quickly tell you a couple of kind of interesting properties that they have. So the first of these properties is something that the models inherit from the fact that you have this fractionalization. And this is something that's called topological order, okay? And if you have something with fractional charge, you always get some kind of topological order. And basically, you know, again, maybe I'm a numericist and I like to diagonalize Hamiltonians. And what you will find in these systems is if you diagonalize your Hamiltonian on a system with periodic boundary conditions, okay, that looks like a torus or a three torus in three dimensions, you'll find that actually there's a ground state degeneracy. Okay, it's going to be p squared, turns out, in this case. Okay, but if you now do the same thing and you know you kind of distort your lattice and put the system on a sphere, you'll find that the ground state degeneracy is always one. So that's one of the signatures of what we call topological order. the second kind of interesting property that these systems have is something that they inherit from topological insulators. So in three-dimensional topological insulators, there's something that we call the magnetoelectric effect, okay, which is basically the following. So let's imagine that I have my topological insulator here, and I'm going to preserve time reversal symmetry in the bulk, but I'm going to break it on the surface. Here, okay. Now, you find that when you do this, what happens is here's my surface Dirac cone. Okay, this is what the surface states look like. I'm going to open up a little gap here. I'm allowed to do that now because time reversal is broken on the surface. And you find that once you open up this gap, what you have is a system that has a half integer Hall conductivity. Okay. Okay, so if you do this, sorry, so the, in particular, sorry, the Hall conductivity is a half E squared over H if you do this in a non-interacting topological insulator. So when you do this in a topological insulator where you have a Dirac cone where the charge carriers have charge QF instead of E, basically it works the same way, except that sigma XY is going to be a half QF squared over H. Okay, so you basically get a half half of a sort of fractional Hall conductivity, if you like, on this surface. Okay, good. So that's a model for a candidate fractional topological insulator. It has some these gapless edge modes. It has topological order. It has this sort of fractional magnetoelectric effect. Maybe sort of words that you might have heard before. Okay, and how we did that, again, was, you know, we had an exactly solvable model with fractionally charged fermions, and that allowed us to really put them in a band structure. Okay, so now, as I said, this model is very, very special. And what I'd like to know is, you know, are these really topological insulators? And what I mean by that is, are these protected edge modes a feature of some kind of phase of matter rather than kind of a fluke that is there, you know, when I have this very special Hamiltonian? Okay, so are these gapless edge modes always there unless I break time reversal at the surface? Okay, so that's the question that we want to address now. So let me start by saying a couple of things about, you know, how time, a little bit more about how time reversal is important in the non-interacting topological insulator. So at the crux of the matter is what we call Cramer's theorem. And what it says is, okay, so you know, time reversal sends momentum to minus itself. Now, there are certain special points in the Brillouin zone. So, for example, in one dimension, if I take the momentum k to be 0 or pi, then that particular momentum will map to itself under time reversal, right? So pi is equivalent to minus pi, 0 goes to 0. So if I sit at one of these points, one of these special points, and I'm studying a system in which if I apply time reversal twice, that gives me a phase of minus one, okay? Then, which is true, for example, in fermionic systems, this is true. Then, if I have one state here, then I also have to have another state. Okay, so this is called a Cramer's degeneracy. So what this tells me, you know, in particular, this was sort of a picture that in the very introduction of the talk, when we were sort of looking at what these edge states looked like as they cross between the valence and conduction bands, we had this little picture of a spin down going one way and a spin up going the other way. Okay, and there was this little crossing. Okay, and what this theorem tells me is that I can't get rid of this crossing, right? So let's imagine that I tried to, add a perturbation that opened a gap here. But then since there's only one state up here and one state down here, these two points don't have Cramer's partners. Okay, so we know that that can't happen unless I've actually broken time reversal. Okay, so what does this have to do with topological insulators? Well, here's a picture that if you've sort of heard a bunch of people give talks about topological insulators, you may have seen before. So what people like to say is, okay, let me think about the band structure and let me ask whether the total number of Cramer's pairs, okay, in the edge state spectrum is even or odd. Okay, so what I've drawn here is basically we're looking at, I'm imagining, this is a cartoon picture, but I'm imagining that I did some numerics on some Hamiltonian. Okay, and here's a bunch of bulk bands that are occupied. Here's a bunch of bulk bands that are empty. And I'm plotting, this is a two-dimensional system with a one-dimensional edge. And this edge is running along the y direction. Okay, and I'm plotting this as a function of ky. And so the kind of picture that people like to give is, well, let's say that, so here's a Cramer's pair here, and here's another one here, okay, and here's another one here, here's another one here. I should say this because this is kind of small. This point here is ky is 0. This point here is ky is equal to pi, okay? Because, of course, from pi to 2 pi is the same. Okay, so I'm only drawing this one part. So the point is, if I have an even number of these Cramer's pairs, then basically these states can connect up like this. And, there might be some points where I see edge modes, but generically I could just put my chemical potential, for example, in here, and I would see nothing. Now, in a topological insulator, the total number of Cramer's points is going to be odd. And in that case, when you try and connect up, because you know there have to be two states at all of these points here, you see that the only choice that you have is to draw a line that starts in this valence band and ends on this conduction band. Okay? And now I have some gapless edge mode because anywhere I want to put my chemical potential in here, it's going to have to cross this line. So there's always going to be a gap. So that's one way to think about topological insulators. Now that's very useful if you want to think about a non-interacting system, right? Because here I have a band structure. That's okay if I'm thinking about a non-interacting system. But we want something a little bit more robust than that, because in these exactly solvable models, generically, if I perturb away from this kind of very special solvable point, my system is going to be interacting. Okay. So the way that you do this is that we're going to imagine the following thought experiment. So instead of thinking about my system kind of on a plane, let's imagine that I'm studying a system on a very long cylinder. Okay, and now I'm going to be allowed to put a flux through this cylinder. Okay, and then the cylinder is time reversal invariant. Okay, the system is time reversal invariant if I pick this flux either to be 0 or pi. Okay, because again, the flux has to go to itself under time reversal. Now. Okay, now, so what happens as I insert, if I change the flux from 0 to pi, is that basically, let's imagine that I start in a system that, okay, I had two states here. Let's imagine that these two states were both occupied, okay? So there is a Cramer's degeneracy at this momentum, but the ground state itself is unique, okay? Because if I apply time reversal to this ground state, these states are both filled. Okay, and that goes to another system which both of these states are filled. So the ground state here is what we call not Cramer's degenerate. Okay, and now if I thread pi flux through the cylinder, okay, so these states are going to flow over here, and they end up over here, and again they're both filled. Okay, so this ground state again is not Cramer's degenerate. Okay, now conversely, if I look at the topological insulator, okay? And I start over here at zero flux, and let's say that both of these states are filled. Now I thread pi flux, okay? One of them flows off into the bulk. And so over here at this flux, I actually have a ground state in which only one of the two states in the Cramer's doublet is occupied, okay? So this ground state has a Cramer's degeneracy in the sense that if you apply time reversal to the ground state, you get back to a different state. Okay, so you can use this to characterize topological insulators by simply saying, okay, let's play this game on the cylinder. And basically, if I'm in a topological insulator, then either at zero flux, the ground state is Cramer's degenerate, and at pi flux, it's not, or at zero flux, the ground state is not Cramer's degenerate, and at pi flux, it is. Okay. Now, if I'm in an ordinary insulator, either both of these have a Cramer's degeneracy, or both of them do not. Okay, so there's an odd even kind of criterion. And so, and Fu and Kane showed, maybe for those of you who have worked on topological insulators, Fu and Kane showed that this criterion is indeed exactly equivalent to the kind of band structure invariant that that people alternatively use to characterize topological insulators. Okay. So, okay. So now I can use this criterion to actually construct a low-lying excited state in the system. So let's say that I am starting with zero flux in my cylinder, okay? And I know that I have this property that the total that at zero flux I don't have a Cramer's degeneracy, but at pi flux I do. Okay. So how is this related to the fact that there is a low-lying edge mode at zero flux? Well, okay. So this x-axis, I didn't put it on here, but this x-axis is going to be the flux going through the cylinder. So I'm going to start in my ground state at zero flux. That's unique. Okay, so I that's its own time reverse conjugate. Okay, now I thread pi flux through the cylinder. Okay, so now I know that this point here, this system with pi flux, is Cramer's degenerate. So let's apply time reversal and look at its time reverse conjugate. Okay. And now let's remove the pi flux again. Okay, so now I go back to the original state with zero flux. And when I do this, you know, because these two states are orthogonal over here, I come back to a state that is orthogonal to the ground state. And, you know, generically it might have some higher energy, but this gap has to vanish in the thermodynamic limit when I make the cylinder very large. Okay, so this other state here is actually, in the thermodynamic limit, a low-lying edge states. Okay, so so far we've talked about what happens, you know, how this works for sort of like basically non-interacting topological insulators. Okay, and we've said that okay, we can use this flux insertion argument to explicitly show that there has to be some low-lying protected edge state if the total number of Cramer's degeneracies at zero flux and pi flux is odd. Okay. So this is the argument that you can generalize and to the fractionalized case. And this was done actually by Levin and Stern in 2009 for the two-dimensional case. Okay. So basically, the argument is exactly the same as what I just told you about for ordinary sort of non-interacting topological insulators, except that except for one subtle difference, okay, which is that if I have an excitation that has fractional charge and I put a pi flux through my cylinder, okay, then you know, this is a fraction of a charge, so its Berry phase as it goes around this pi flux is not pi, it's some complex number, okay? So this state, once I put pi flux through, is not its own time reverse conjugate, okay? So that's, and that's actually related to this topological degeneracy of ground states that I mentioned was a feature that always comes along when you have fractional charge. So what we need to do, instead of inserting some pi flux to the cylinder, we have to insert some multiple of pi fluxes through the cylinder. What multiple does it have to be? Well, it has to be if the charge of the if the smallest possible charge in the system is, you know, 1 over q, some 1 over some integer q, then I have to insert q times pi flux, okay? So here the q is this ratio e over e star, where e star is like the minimal charge. And, okay, so now what you find is, so you do this, and you ask from the point of view of the fermions,
I've inserted some integer multiple of pi flux through my cylinder. Okay. Now, and what you find is that if QF over E star is an odd number, then what the fermions see is that you have is basically that you've inserted some pi flux through the cylinder. From their point of view, that's what it looks like. And so you can use this argument where I start in a state that has that's not Cramer's degenerate, and I insert some flux, and I go to a state that is Cramer's degenerate, and I can use that to explicitly construct a low-lying mode. Okay. Now, conversely, if QF over E star is even, what the fermions see is basically an insertion of two pi flux through the cylinder. Okay. So the Cramer's degeneracy of the ground state of the fermionic ground state is not going to change. So so let me just summarize. So, you know, so far I've actually just been talking about 2D, and we've said that in two dimensions we can use these flux insertion arguments to show that if QF over E star is odd, the system, you know, has some low-lying excitation. So that's our protected edge mode. And if QF over E star is even, actually this argument fails, and you can show by explicit construction that in fact these edge states are not protected and can be gapped. Can be gapped out by a perturbation at the edge that does not break time reversal, I should say. Okay, so, yeah.
QF over E in terms of the parameters P and K that you were using.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, so.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, so there's yeah, so you might want to just write, well, I insert P
it's in
flux, but in fact the minimal charge is if P is even, you have this factor of a half. So that's the. Yeah. Okay, good. So now without going into detail, let me just say that in three dimensions, you can construct a very similar argument. Okay, the geometry is a little different. Instead of thinking about a cylinder, I have to think about a thickened torus. But you know, again, basically, I can play this game where I insert some number of fluxes and basically they change the Cramer's degeneracy of the fermionic ground state if QF over E star is odd. And so in three dimensions, the conclusion that you come to is if QF over E star is odd, we can use these flux insertion arguments to say that there really is a low-lying surface mode. Okay, so there's a protected, you know, essentially in the thermodynamic limit, there's a protected gapless surface mode. If QF over E star is even, actually we don't know. So that's kind of an interesting open question. Because we don't know how to add a perturbation that would gap it out that preserves time reversal. Okay, so that's it. So let me just kind of summarize the important results. So the first thing I did was, you know, tell you about a model of fractional insulators or candidate fractional topological insulators. Okay, and it had fractionally charged fermions. It was exactly solvable, and that allowed us to think about having a band structure for these fractionally charged fermions. And it had these sort of gapless edge or surface states with these interesting properties like a fractional magneto-electric effect and topological order. And then we asked, well, are these really fractional topological insulators? And we found that, you know, basically if you pick the parameters of the model right, such that QF over E star is odd, then you do indeed get protected gapless, you know, again, in the thermodynamic limit, protected gapless edge or surface modes, both in two dimensions and three dimensions. And if QF over E star is even, then we know in two dimensions, actually, that these are not what you would like to call topological insulators. And in three dimensions, we actually don't know. Okay. So that's.
Someone else should ask a question.
So how would the physical properties of a fractional topological insulator differ from a regular topological insulator? So if I'm an experimentalist and I want to determine what type of topological insulator I have, mm-hmm. how do I go about that?
Okay, so probably the most robust, you know, property experimentally would be actually if you had this 3D system to actually break time reversal on the surface and measure the Hall conductance. Because this is, and typically, you know, you would have some kind of, so the Hall conductance was like a half of some fractional number, right? But typically, you'd have some kind of slab, and probably
when you measure the thing, you get a contribution from both edges. So what you would find is basically a system where if you add, you know, you might want to add a little magnetic layer at the surface that had, that when you did that, it spontaneously, you know, developed this fractionally quantized Hall conductance. That's probably the most, the simplest thing to measure in the sense that people know how to use transport measurements, and it's a very clear signature because it's quantized. Yeah.
So what's the experimental situation of topological insulators, ordinary ones as well as fractional? To what extent can these things be realized in the lab?
Oh, okay. So, wow, that's a good question. So on the fractional side of things, you know, at this point, this is very much a theoretical game. And, you know, obviously the Hamiltonians that I wrote down here are not very good models of, you know, probably any physical system unless you really engineer things very carefully. And there's another kind of school of thought where people are starting to think about if you could engineer band structures, okay, and make bands very flat and have very strongly interacting electrons, maybe you could get to some interesting fractional phases along there. But the fractional topological insulators right now is you know, it's really a theoretical game. Now, the non-fractional, okay, so that if you like non-interacting topological insulators, is a sort of a different story. So, you know, so basically, if you start looking through the literature, you see all kinds of, you know, there's many experimental papers about three-dimensional topological insulators, and what you'll see is, so, you know, is things like this. Maybe I can go back. Oops. Pictures. So something you might see. Right. Is pictures like this, where basically, you know, they're shining light on the surface of the material, and they're measuring how the light scatters, and they're probing the density of state of the electron system, okay, and they say, look, we actually see these surface diachrons. However, okay, there's a little caveat that a lot of people don't like to talk about, which is that, you know, okay, so this is a system that has these, like, gapless, you know, diachrons on the surface, and that's very exciting. But it's actually the materials that people have right now are actually not insulators. So, you know, basically there's some other, you know, part of the brilliant zone where these bulk bands that they've kind of isolated here actually cross the chemical potential. And so although you can see these surface states doing, you know, for example, our kinds of light scattering experiments, it's very difficult to detect them using transport. Because materials are not yet bulk insulators. So that's kind of a barrier in the three-dimensional case.
It, probably one should add that one could put all kinds of things on the surface, methylated or something like that, and the structure is invariant. So
right.
That's very beautiful.
Yeah. Okay.
So if the your fractional charge is 1 over b, uh-huh. Do you get b diachrons on the surface?
No, actually, and that's, if you're familiar with, like, parton constructions for you know, fractional insulators, that's one way in which this differs. So if you do a parton construction, you basically create something that has charged 1 over p, and the Hall conductance would be, 1 over p squared, you know, say I break time was on the surface and I have a Hall conductance of 1 over p squared, but there are p different diachrons in that model. Okay, so then you get an extra factor of p. Now, in this case, there really is, you know, there is just one kind of fermion, so it's a single diachron. So all the fermions are, so when you partonize, you make sort of three objects of charge a third, and so there's really three different flavors of electronic band, for example. Here there really is only one different flavor, so it's just a single diachron.
So why does it matter then, you know, what if p is even or odd?
Okay. Well, it's actually not the criterion is not whether p is even or odd, but actually this. So let's.
So what's E star? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So let's go back. Maybe we should. Oh, sorry. Okay, don't put animations in the top. Okay, so where are we? Right. Okay. So. Okay. So. Okay. So. So. The point is, it's not only P that's important. So. So. If P, it's true that if P is odd, this number is always odd. But also, you know, if P is even, you have this factor of a half, so you can't choose P and K such that this number is still odd. So you're asking kind of, you know, intuitively what's going on. So what you might find surprising is that if this number is even, you know, these edge loads are not protected. In this case, so why are the edge loads not protected? Well, if you added some very weak perturbation at this edge, you know, they would still be there. But what actually turns out is that, you know, when this number is even, you can add a perturbation that excites some of the bosonic excitations that are not in this purely fermionic picture. And, you know, if it so happens that this number is even, those excitations can interact with the gapless edge loads in such a way that they don't break time reversal, but they do open a gap.
So in the simplest case, P equals 2 and K equals 1, this number is even.
Okay, right. So, yes.
So what are the two states that mix that? It must be possible to see that explicitly.
Well, okay, so I should say one thing about that, which is that in this model, actually, if P equals 2 and K equals 1, this factor of 2 came from the fact that the bosonic charge was twice the electron charge. So that actually is a model that doesn't even have fractional charge. I don't know if that's okay. That's a little bit different. But even there, if you just looked at the fermions actually have now so you have you
sorry,
have
sorry,
so, so, so the, fer- the fermions.
I'm going to miss something here. So uh-huh. if P equals 2, that's uh-huh. C2 fractionalization.
That's right.
And then if K equals 1, that means you're binding one electron
to one boson. Yeah, so the reason...
That is a model that does not have fractionalization.
What I mean is the electron doesn't carry fractional charge. So it has... So there is topological order. It does have Z2 topological order. But the actual charge of the electron, because the boson charge is 2e instead of e, okay, and p gives you a factor of half. So these electrons would be carrying, actually, these composite fermions carry charge 3e, okay? And then you say, okay, so I have some model, that's not important, okay? I have some model that looks like I just put it in the band structure of a topological insulator. And basically what's going on there is, if you just look at the fermionic sector, I mean, it's like a... The fermionic sector is like a non-attracting topological insulator, but it's very important that you have these other bosonic excitations. So it's actually, you know, the fact that you can make these sort of vortices is important.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the way that you do this is you actually look at kind of the Luttiger theory of the edge, and you look at the possible kind of sine Gordon terms, and unfortunately, I don't have a kind of simple, like, intuitive explanation of how it works. Sorry.
Okay.
Oh, there's one more back. Yeah.
So I think I remember there's often some sort of Turin-Simons description lurking around
uh-huh.
the situation. Is there something here like that? And if so, since you have an exact model, a completely controlled model, can you show the emergence of this Turin-Simons terms and so on?
So that's a good question. So let's think about the 2D system first. So in some sense, the 2D system is like having a double Turin-Simons case, because Turin-Simons theory is chiral. You have, but if you take it and you have a right handed Turin-Simons term and a left-handed Turin-Simons term, that you know, that's very close to the field theory that, that captures what's going on. In practice, okay, the appropriate, sorry, so you can write down a field theory that captures basically what's going on in the bosonic model, okay? And so what that can tell you about is, like, I have these bosonic excitations that carry fractional charge, and I have these excitations in the kinetic term, okay? And it turns out that those have, like, non-trivial mutual statistics. And to capture that, so that's like a discrete gauge here, and you can capture those statistics by looking at a two-dimensional BF theory, which is very closely related to interference Simons theory. And essentially also in three dimensions, you know, in these models are all abelian, okay? So in the abelian case, you know, you can convince yourself that the bosonic model is you know, basically, you can capture its topological properties by just looking at a BF theory. Does that sort of address what you're interested in?
I think so. Yeah. So you can somehow show explicitly how this BF series comes out.
You can sort of make a mapping from the excitations in the bosonic model and say, okay, if I have a violation of my QS squared is not in the ground state, then, you know, that looks like a source, and if I have a violation of the kinetic term, you know, that looks like a vortex, and so that's how it maps onto the discrete gauge theory. And then the discrete gauge theory is, you know, basically described, if you like, by the BF.
How much control can you have on the ground state? Because, I mean, you can use these for topological quantum computations, right? Which is the topological order, for example. Mm-hmm. And if you play with the fluxes and everything.
Well, I mean, so right now, I decided that since I'm a theorist, I can write down any Hamiltonian I want. So I have a lot of control over it. I can, you know, but one comment about that, though, is that if you're interested in, you know, for example, topological quantum computation, so you'll hear the words abelian and non-abelian thrown around, and maybe not to get into detail, but the kind of statistics, okay, that these models have, there is a non-trivial statistic. So you have some excitation in the kinetic sector has non-trivial statistics with the excitation in the vertex, okay? But the kind of statistics that these have are not sufficient to make universal quantum gates. But there are lattice models that do. Mm-hmm. Hamiltonians, you can write down the principle, that do have such excitations that you could really use.
No other questions?